Sadly, at that point, Duke decided to conduct an internal review of this, and Duke decided that, in fact, Nevins and Potty's work was sound, and they proceeded with the clinical trials. That was a bad decision. Further scrutiny led them to reverse that decision, but this gives us, I think, a nice microcosm of some of the issues that arise. And particularly, what we will see, I think, over and over again, is that there's a lot of institutional inertia at the universities, at the journals, and within our own culture that makes it very, very hard to achieve successful change in the reproducibility world. There are a couple of other cases. Ken Cuccinelli, the Attorney General for the state of Virginia, believes that Michael Mann committed criminal acts in his analysis of global warming data and is subpoenaing the University of Virginia for his records. And for all of these reasons, there have been a lot of high-profile media attention to the potential for non-reproducible research, or the quality of scientific research, or the validity of it. And I think we probably all agree that it would be really, really nice if people thought that our research were valid. And it would be even better if it actually were. Let's see. For my sins, I am a former editor of the Journal of the American Statistical Association, and I have to say that it's my personal opinion that a very large proportion of the papers that we have been publishing are not perfectly reproducible. And these are mostly innocent issues. It's very hard to write a paper in which you exactly explain all of the pre-modeling that goes on that involved your choice of this data set to work upon, how you sort of decided what variable selection procedure you would use, what modeling techniques you would consider, how you would remove outliers, how you would clean the data. And those are all sort of subliminal decisions that ought to be part of a perfectly reproducible study, but rarely get actually documented completely in a paper. And if they were documented in a paper, I am sure that the stupid editor would say, oh, no, the paper's too long, shorten it. And so it would all get thrown out anyway. The point is that reproducibility is a much larger problem than the occasional high-profile cases that we have seen. And it's important to remember that the low-level cases and the high-level cases represent points along the continuum from very, very innocent mistakes that anybody might make that are just part of the normal business of doing research. If you're not making those mistakes, then you're not doing your research. And then over at the other extreme, you have got things that border upon or perhaps cross the line into academic fraud. And where any particular case falls along that spectrum is obviously going to be a matter of debate. But I think the main thing is not to try and cry foul on particularly bad cases, so much as to create an environment in which everybody does better. There are some special roles that statisticians have played in the reproducibility research frontier. I guess you can go back to Fisher pointing out that Mendel had an overzealous assistant, which was perhaps the early days of all this. But in the modern world, you've got to give special credit to Jeff McLaughlin and Ambrose, who did some early work on forensic statistics and found that several published papers were just basically not correct. You've got Keith Bagley, Kevin Combs, and Jeff Morris, who reanalyzed the famous Petrocoin and Leota data on the first stage ovarian cancer with proteomic signals. And actually, I knew Emmanuel Petrocoin, Chip Petrocoin, at that time, and I was telling him, you know, you really ought to talk to a statistician before you rush forward. And he said, no, I'm under too much pressure from my bosses. I've got to get this stuff out. It's really, really hot. And so he cut corners and paid the price for it, and that work is entirely discredited now, and it's been very painful for the people who work with him. Rob Tibshirani got involved in this, looking at follicular lymphoma, and found the previously published work was just not sound. You've got, and perhaps an institutional success. I would like to give props to the statisticians, the army of statisticians at the Food and Drug Administration, who for decades have been doing reproducible research studies over and over again to test whether or not the claims that are made by pharmaceutical drug companies and new drug applications are in fact valid. So we have, as a community, developed special ideas and made special efforts to improve reproducibility across many disciplines. And I hope that this panel discussion will be yet another stepping stone along the way to better practice. So with that sort of beginning, I would like to raise the sort of questions that the panelists are going to address, recognizing that we're going to wander all over the place in terms of our discussion. And sadly, I've left that page down, but let me see if I can remember. One question has to do with what is the role of institutions in ensuring reproducible research? What is the role of funding agencies in ensuring reproducible research? What is the role of journals in ensuring reproducible research? And what is the role of co-authors and the collaborators in ensuring that the work is done appropriately? Beyond that, you have some larger scale questions which have to do with the role of the discipline and the possibility that there may be, well, let me say, technological assets that could be mustered to improve reproducibility. It's not going to happen just with technology, probably. People are involved. But we hope that we put the right kinds of technology in line, we can make the cultural shift much easier. So that's where we're trying to go today, people. And now I would like to introduce Larry Kessler, who will come up and say a few words from his perspective on these problems. Larry?
The on off button may be on the bottom, you just have to hold it in until.
Okay, Keith will figure that out while I'm talking. Right there.
I want to thank David for the introduction. And I'm trying to figure out how to face, and you guys need to realize, as some of you have been speakers before, for the four of us sitting here having to look sort of this way, you know, we're going to need ibuprofen later today to fix the neck fix. So I'm going to make a couple of overarching comments. And as David was speaking about this, sort of a new thought crept in my mind, and it has to do with airline safety and spaceflight safety. Because they don't have a chance to do reproducible things. When they fly something, if it doesn't work the first time, a whole bunch of people die. So there's some safety lessons here, and I think I'll get to some of that a little bit later in talking about this. I'll stay here for a moment. So David raised a few questions. I'm going to make a few summary points and turn it over to Keith. I'm not going to spend a long time up here. One of the first questions he asked is, well, what's the investigator's personal responsibility with respect to research ethics in his or her own laboratory? What is the real controls here? And I think before we start that, I wanted to give some context to some of this, because I think we need to think about whether all the errors we're talking about are of the same magnitude of importance. And should we have a hierarchy of the things that we think need to be reproduced? I mean, do you want to reproduce everything? And I'll give you an example of why I think this is not realistic. I was talking with a colleague last night about some late-stage drug trials that they're involved in. We're talking about budget, and the trial that she's talking about happens to be about $40 million. People have estimated what it takes to bring a drug to market. David complimented the FDA statisticians in the FDA process for having a high level of quality built into it because of reproducibility and people actually assigned to relook at the data. But it costs drug companies roughly, depending on who you talk to, somewhere between $500 or $600 million up to $1 billion to get a drug trial through. That's not a reproducible system. Every time somebody has a series of studies, we're not going to reproduce $40 million trials over and over and over. So we need to think about some sort of hierarchy. And the way the FDA does it when it comes to products, that tries to pitch its regulatory control to the risk of the product. So I think one of the things we ought to think about is what kind of studies, if they're strikingly positive and may affect patient care right away, may be at the front of the list for reproducibility, and negative results a little bit further back, depending on the flavor of those negative results, and results that might be about some conditions that are less injurious or perhaps are in a pathway to treatment. So a diagnostic test, you may want to have certain kinds of reproducibility, but because that may be confirmed by later clinical examination, you may have a different threshold. So I think it's important for us to think about errors in different ways or studies that need to be reproduced. It's also worth repeating some of the things that David mentioned about the economics of the situation and the reward system. So I've spent 13 years at FDA, 10 years before that at NCI, now I'm in academia, and the risk and reward systems. Actually, I'm sorry to hear about Chip feeling pressure about getting research results out. I think all of us feel that to some degree. I think actually that's a bit of a false dodge. I mean, we all feel the same pressure. I think the pressure should be to get good results out, and I think it's responsible of all of us to make sure that what we are emphasizing, particularly to our junior investigators, it's much more important to get a couple of good papers out than a slew of bad papers out. And I think it's something that we as senior members of academia have to emphasize, and it's something I've said to my faculty, and I think it's actually an important cultural shift that we have to adopt, that bean counting is less important than quality, and I think it's something that the societies ought to be behind and part of. One of the things that he mentioned at FDA is there are a slew of statisticians there who toil in largely in anonymity reproducing results. So I think that's actually important because there's an economic system, meaning there are people who actually get paid for this. Some of that same work would not generally be acceptable in academia. It wouldn't get you a reward, wouldn't get you promoted. So it's why there is a cadre of people at the FDA. And I think it's unfortunate that the FDA at the moment is probably on some sort of an onslaught by members of Congress for budget cuts. David asked about journal role. I'm going to skip over that. That's not something that I want to spend a lot of time in, but I'm going to talk a little bit about institutional roles and then about federal agencies, and then I'll get off the dais. So, institutional roles. So, I think there are several roles for the host institutions, primarily academic institutions, that should really focus on different features of the scientific process. So I think institutions should help with infrastructure. So there should be a role in the institutional setting where you have graduate assistants, students, et cetera, who are there available for reproducibility checking, et cetera. I think that's something institutions can and should do. There should be an encouragement to have an open dialogue about the research, works in progress, people looking at each other's data. I think that should be part of the institutional approach to how it deals with research results. I think that there should be appropriate respect and acknowledgement when researchers open up their work. So if I'm spending my time doing some of this, I send my research results to Keith. You want to make sure institution supports that work, that that's in the community service kind of feature. So when you get reviewed by your senior mentors and you say, I spent part of my time checking Keith's work from MD Anderson, but I'm at the Hutch in Seattle, or I'm at Memorial Sloan Kettering, or I'm at the NIH, that should be part of the system. That's part of community service, and not to be denigrated. One of the tough things will be support for the promotion process. All of us know that the article in Biometrica, the article in JASA, the independent R01 that you get is what you get promoted for, not reproducing somebody else's research results. And I'm not sure that's going to be changeable. It'd be nice if there were some little asterisk for some of this, but I'm not sure that's going to happen. And I think an institution can establish oversight boards and spend some money and resources for oversight of high priority research. I'm going to turn briefly to NIH and the FDA role. So FDA has a very different role than the NIH. And I'll speak about the FDA role first and return to the NIH and end with a suggestion I think would be important that I'm going to try and carry forward. The FDA role is regulatory. It's the job of the individuals at the Food and Drug Administration to make sure the products that are put on the market are safe and effective and remain safe and effective in their continued use. When you try to get a drug onto the market or a device onto the market, it's a number of the regulatory machinery aspects that are worth noting. And one of the most important ones are the quality system requirements or the quality manufacturing part of the products. And one of the reasons that when you decide to try and put a product to the market, you roll a truckload of documents up to the FDA, is that there is an excruciating level of documentation of every research step. So the kind of things David talked about, gee, do you think about, which hypotheses do you think about? What about your analysis plan? How many models did you try before you landed on the right one? And so you do need correction for multiple comparisons. Are you protecting your type 1 and type 2 error correctly, et cetera, et cetera? Actually, I'm a Bayesian, so I don't have a lot of belief in type 1 and type 2 error. But you can't get away from multiple looks at data. You can't get away from that. And all of that research process has to be documented. The product doesn't go forward. And frankly, it was very interesting for me to move from the NIH to FDA and discover that a large amount of the research that I was part of at the NIH would never pass muster. at FDA because there wasn't that quality system control. So if those of you have not need some bedtime reading and have not looked at it, you might look at the quality system requirements or the quality manufacturing product regulations. The documentation necessary for the scientific process is excruciatingly detailed, but protects the American public against obvious situations where things are not reproducible. And so I think that's really important, and there should be some lessons in our research processes we take from that. I don't think the economic system is well designed to include that. I think that's part of the problem, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So for the NIH, I actually have one suggestion I'm going to end on, because I think it's pretty important. And I think that particularly in the era of biomarkers and complex signature approaches and omics that we're working in, I think the NIH should insist that every study that it's going to support come with a plan for reproducibility on the front end. And the funding package has to include resources to support reproducibility by an independent body. Most likely, it would be nice if we're in an academic setting, it's not likely to be. It'll probably be more like a CRO doing that. And I think the NIH needs to recognize that there's a fee, and if it's going to support David and Keith's next research project at $3.7 million, that there's going to be a tariff, see? There'll be a tariff of 10%, and they're going to have to put aside $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 only for somebody to do the reproducibility work. And it's going to be done under contract. It's going to be somebody not connected to Keith and David. And that's part of the way that research ought to be done. And they have to suggest how it ought to be done on the front end. And if you can't think about how your research should be challenged in reproducibility, then we're not going to fund you on the first end. And I think that's something the NIH can and should do. I'm going to end with that. Thank you.
Thank you.